This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, herd linguistic cats. Today's episode is the annual bonus Allusionist, featuring outtakes from some of this year's guests saying things that were not necessarily related to the topic of the original episode, or even related to language at all. But I thought, interesting, and filed them away until this moment. This is not a typical episode of The Allusionist, so if this is your first time here, welcome, and do try a few different episodes of the show to get a picture. This year, there have been episodes about your names and superhero names, about how swearing can be good for your health and so can fiction, about tattoos and typing champions, about how the drive to survive sent the Welsh language across an ocean and the Scots language to hide at home, and many more episodes besides. Thanks so much for spending time with me over 2018. There is one swear in this episode. Place your bets on which one. On with the show.
I first got introduced to language really when I was about 8 or 9, and my grandparents bought me a dictionary for Christmas, and I sat and read it cover to cover like you would read a Dickens. I was just obsessed with it. It was fantastic.
This is Paul Anthony Jones, who appeared on the episode Triumph Trumpet Top Fart. Under the guise of Haggard Hawks, Paul writes about words and etymology. Quite a few words have rather odd and grisly origins, such as the slang term Kennedy.
In 19th century slang, Kennedy was to kill someone with a poker.
Oh.
We don't really know an awful lot about it, apart from the fact that someone called Kennedy was killed with a poker in the early 1800s. Who the guy was, how brutal the crime was, we don't really know anything about it. We just know that it was enough for the word in that sense to end up in sort of London slang in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. It didn't seem to last very long, but it's found its way into the dictionary ever since. So you look up Kennedy, and there you have this pretty bizarre definition before anything else.
It must have been a pretty bad death by poker. Not that there are good ones.
No.
But it must have been a bad one for it to catch on in that way.
Yeah, yeah. It must. Something has put it sort of into the consciousness of the city. So it must have been pretty brutal, I'm guessing. But there's all sorts of words like that. If you burk someone, it means to strangle or suffocate them. That comes from the burk, as in Birkenhead, because that's what he used to do. If you bishop someone, then you drown them. That was another resurrectionist who used to go around drowning people, and he did that in London in the 19th century and sold the body to science. So to bishop is to drown someone. 19th century London isn't coming out of this very well.
Yeah, it seems rough.
Yeah, kind of alongside these names that have become crimes because of people. Coventry is in the dictionary as a verb meaning to slit someone's nose. That comes from Sir John Coventry, who was a politician in sort of mid-late 1600s. And he made a comment in the House of Commons about Charles II and his relationship with Nell Gwynne. It was a pretty shady comment, and it was in a debate about taxation of the theatres. And everybody laughed, as you do in politics, apart from the Duke of Monmouth, who was Charles II's son, who happened to be in the House of Commons at the time. And he wasn't too impressed with this, got together with a bunch of troops and a bunch of friends and decided to hunt John Coventry down later on that night. Coventry, of course, being a politician, stayed in the pub until 2 o'clock in the morning, and then was set upon in the street and had his nose cut down to the bone.
Ooh.
Underneath. It sounds pretty brutal, but he survived and was back in Parliament probably a couple of days later. But this ended up leading to an Act of Parliament called the Coventry Act, which forbid the cutting off of any member. It's phrased like that, which is a bit curious. But this led to this Act of Parliament that made any kind of attack like this on a member of Parliament a felony, specifically made it a felony. And that remained on the statute books for until early 19th century. It was on for a really long time. So this really bizarre crime on this guy in the 1670, I think it was, has led to this word ending up in the dictionary. It's not a word that's particularly well used, I have to admit. But in terms of political names that have ended up with very, very bizarre and unpolitical meanings, it's certainly up there among the strangest.
Glenn Weldon appeared on the episode Supername, talking about how comic book superheroes got their names and their capes.
Capes were part of this whole original idea of what a superhero is, because they came from this notion of the trapeze artist, like the circus strongman. And back in the days of the circus, the trapeze artist would have a cape when they'd come out to as the visual flourish, but then they'd climb to the platform, and the first thing they would do is they would get rid of the cape. The cape would fall to the ground, and then they would do their stuff. So that's kind of a trend that's been followed in comics too, where before, back in the days, in the 1930s and 40s, capes. But as we started to bring them back in the 60s and 70s, we lost the capes.
No capes! The academic Guy Cuthbertson appeared in the episode A Novel Remedy, about how fiction can help people recover from illnesses or traumas such as the First World War. Here he talks about how that war begat a trend towards getting back to nature.
It's about rejecting this modern world and rejecting this capitalist structure, and about getting back to the land and the simple life. And that, of course, is still a very strong theme through the 20s and 30s, and again, very explicitly connected to ideas of convalescence and recovery, is this alternative way of life and getting back to nature and so on. And also, this is the period of great popularity of camping as well. And indeed, nudism and nudist camps, I think, go hand in hand with that idea. The ultimate simple life is to go off on your holidays and kind of let it all hang out. Some ideas about where it emerges from are that it came out of soldiers in the trenches, where if you've been covered in mud and gore and all of that, the one thing you looked forward to was actually stripping those clothes off. And indeed, sunbathing became quite popular when they had the chance, given as that's the contrast to the usual image of trench warfare as being mud and rain.
Do you think one reason for this popularity of the idea of pastoral living and simple living was because class structure had been somewhat broken down by the First World War?
Yeah, I mean, the strange thing about the First World War is that it reinforces class structures and breaks them down at the same time. So you get that image of everyone being in the trenches together. So it is true that the son of the manor is going to be in the same trench as the guy from the factory in Manchester or whatever. But of course, through the idea of one of them being an officer and the other being a private soldier and so on, the actual structures of society are reinforced or emphasized actually by the idea of what rank you are, and indeed which regiment you're in, and that there's a certain sense of snobbery attached to being in certain regiments and not in others. But going back to the land, that idea of the simple life, that is a way of breaking down all class barriers. You know, if you're at a nudist camp, it's impossible to tell who's posh and who isn't until they speak, I suppose. In that, clothes, possessions, those are usually the indicator of where you come from in life and indeed how much money you've got in your wallet. But if you've not even got a wallet on you, there is a sense of it being a way of breaking down class distinction.
Also in A Novel Remedy, clinical psychologist Jane Gregory talked about how fiction can help some people deal with conditions like obsessive compulsive disorder and, in this case, spider phobia.
With spider phobia, they were doing exposure treatment, and the idea behind the exposure treatment is to test out your expectations of what would happen when you're in close proximity to a spider. And so part of it is the fear that the spider will bite you. Part of it is the fear that that would then be life-threatening. Part of the fear is that you'll freak out so much that you won't be able to cope. And so by doing the exposure, you're basically putting yourself close to a spider and testing out that prediction. And what they did was they randomized the group, and half of them watched Charlotte's Web in the middle of the treatment, and the other half just watched a neutral, positive video. And the people who watched Charlotte's Web for the second half of the treatment, they got closer to the spider. They took more steps towards touching the spider or getting really close to the spider than the group that just watched the neutral video. And the outcomes were better for them as well. I think later on they were exposed again to a spider, and their reaction to that spider was much lower than the group who didn't watch Charlotte's Web. So again, it's this idea that a fictional story can help to change your mind about something. It can help to change your expectations and change your behaviour.
Charlotte's Web is a real spider redemption story.
Yeah, it's one of the few spider redemption stories out there.
Tobin Lowe and Kathy Tu of Nancy Podcast came on the show to consider the word queer. And Tobin also talked about a time he was subjected to that infernal question, where are you from? No, where are you really from?
Oh, God, there was a girl, also fellow Asian, so this felt like a crime, like a self-inflicted crime. She was like, where are you from? And I was like, oh, my family's Chinese, which I'm okay, like, just owning that if it's another Asian person. And she literally went, no. I was like, I promise you. But her follow-up was, you're going to find out about something. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Is the insinuation here I'm going to find out that somebody cheated on somebody or like...
Or that you're secretly French.
Yeah.
No, what that is that she has one in her mind, East Asians look a certain way.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And that means you have to be super light-skinned or mm-hmm. something like that. Because mm-hmm. I feel like there's such a stigma there. I mean, I feel like all over the world it's that way.
Yeah. I was into cross-stitching for a while, and I cross-stitched a little thing that says, I get that a lot, because people tell me I don't look Chinese so much that I just cross-stitched that into a thing.
Our song-exploding West Wing Weekler friend, Hrishikesh Hirway, was on the Shark Week episode, dealing with listeners' linguistic queries.
Okay, Helen, here's a question from Lindsay. She asks, I have a question about a word where a basic Google search has failed me.
So I'm deferring the basic Google search to you.
The word is gig and shows up in two very unrelated parts of her life. First, she says, my fiance is a musician and makes upright basses. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
I've been with him on several trips to drop off basses with symphonies in the US, and I've noticed that all musicians refer to jobs as gigs. That's true. That checks out. I can confirm.
Okay.
Whether the job is music related or not.
Huh.
For example, they'll talk about their new gig at a different symphony, and they'll also ask me about my new gig as a professor at a university, which is in business school, so no music there.
I think this is quite common because now you have the gig economy, which is
that's true
a euphemism for insecure freelance work where people are taken advantage of.
Yeah. It's just like a kind of silly musician thing, you know. All musicians want to be cool, and it's cooler to say gig, and it makes you feel like you're more of a professional musician, and that need for legitimacy comes from these external things, and so you're like, yeah, I got a gig. And then because you are so deep into that lifestyle and that word, everything becomes a gig, you know. It's almost even better to be so cool that you apply the word gig even in contexts like this, the professor at a university in the business school, that's your gig.
Do you think some of that behavior might be because when you're in an arts profession, but you're doing jobs to make ends meet that are not related to that,
Oh. You
want it to feel like it's all of a piece rather than those are a mark of failure and a separate thing to your main line of work?
Right, even if it is temporary, just like, oh, I've got a gig tonight. Plus I've got it. And then in the morning, I've got to go show up at my gig at Starbucks.
Yeah. You're trying to create consistency in an inconsistent career path.
Maybe. Let me go on to the next part of it. She says, secondly, I am a lifelong horseback rider. I ride dressage, but recently my mom has gotten into driving horses, and now she's looking to buy a gig, which is also a type of cart, apparently, for the horse to pull. I'd greatly appreciate any insight. Are these two uses related? It seems like as soon as I noticed the word, it started appearing everywhere.
These two types of gig are not related. The employment gig is from music. It's early 1900s jazz scene vocabulary. And it was an abbreviation of engagement,
huh. As
in an engagement to do some work rather than marital.
Right.
The other kind of gig, like Lindsay's mom is planning to buy
the
little cart. It's from a sense of gig that meant things that whirled around or spun.
Like a whirly gig?
Yeah.
Is that where whirly gig comes from?
Yeah, which was a child's toy. But gig was, the same thing, so a spinning top as well.
Yeah.
That's several hundred years old. And so anything that whirled around or is dangerous or unstable was described as a gig. So presumably these carts... The gigs. They were higher, I think, than a lot of horse-drawn carts, so maybe they were a little more perilous.
Mm-hmm. Like when all those SUVs were toppling over.
Yes. Just stay low, people. Stay low to the ground. And then gig was also an insult for young women, like young, flighty, unpredictable women,
huh. As
an extension of that meaning.
Oh, because they were also unstable?
Yeah.
And just whirled around?
Just whirled around. Very dizzy.
I've never heard of it in that context.
No, I think that's one that has sort of slipped out of use. Mm-hmm. And then gig is also a little type of boat that was a ship's captain's special taxi boat. But again, presumably from the same but unstable meaning.
Interesting. So, Lindsay, they're not related. but they unite in you.
And that's it. The Illusionist Vaults are closing for 2018. Please rejoin me in 2019. For you, my precious listeners, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is quillet, noun, a subtlety in argument, a quibble. Try using it in an email today. Convene with me on Facebook and Twitter. Allusionist Show is the handle. And for every episode, and additional materials pertaining to each topic, transcripts, the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and indeed, everything allusional, visit the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.